Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
On today's episode of Worker Movement, we'll talk about measurement error in the context of coronavirus. Our state and federal governments are reporting aggregated COVID-19 case and death counts on a daily basis, but how accurate is this information? The actual facts are obscured by several concepts. We'll start with scientific concepts before progressing into the political.
So whenever any data is reported by any media or government outlet, the first question you should ask is, who collected the data? Is there any bias in the data sets? How are they collecting it? And the second is to ask, in the follow-up with that, how is it collected? Could it be skewed? Are the measurements correct? And in the context of the coronavirus, how do we know that everybody that is actually infected is being tested, or they're actually recording that as a illness or a death?
Well, we don't, and this is probably due to a concept we're calling testing bias, which is, given the substantial burden that the coronavirus is placing in healthcare systems, there's a limited amount of people that are actually being tested. This is limited to patients exhibiting symptoms, and in most cases, only the extreme symptoms. And then even sometimes those people aren't being tested. So of the people being tested, they are the sickest of the sick, or they have some, demographic or other health related risk that makes them more susceptible to the illness, where they can't just be sent home and say, take it easy for a couple of days, you'll be fine.
So with that testing bias, that also goes into death counts, where individuals dying at home or in nursing homes or for pneumonia or strain on the heart or whatever it happens to be may not be tested, right? Because there's no way of knowing that they were actually sick with COVID-19.
Right. They might not be tested while they're alive, and they might not be tested upon death to see if they actually had it.
Right. And that leads into our second concept, which is scarcity. The idea that we don't have the fundamental ability to test everyone. We don't have the fundamental ability, even if we tested everyone, so that means sticking the probe in your nose and getting the mucous membrane coated on the stick, to actually process the data. And we don't actually have a unified testing method that is accurate 100% of the time.
Right. And there's... Right?
And so,
many different tests. There's many different sort of accuracies of these various tests. So, you might do a nasal swab with one test and it tells you you're positive. And you might do a nasal swab, same exact swab with another test and tells you you're not positive.
Yeah, and this is also that testing bias, right? So whose test do you believe? Do you have the whole test? How do you actually validate data when you're moving this fast? How do you validate a test? So if Corona or SARS, COVID 2019, whatever they call it now, is similar to another COVID case, are you just measuring antibodies and responses from another illness, or are you truly measuring that of COVID-19? And then as you report them, are there things like lags in the system? So if you recorded a bunch of people on Tuesday, how long does it actually take to get those test results back? And then depending on the test, how accurate are they? So how many false positives do you have? How many people have you sent home that are still sick? That are super spreaders?
Yeah, and then there's some discussion too about antibody testing, which is this concept of if you get infected with the illness and you recover, the conventional wisdom is that your body will produce antibodies to fight off the COVID-19 illness. And some of these antibody tests also have testing biases where they're only, I shouldn't say they're only, but they're identifying a larger class of coronavirus-related illnesses, of which is the common cold. So there's, again, some test uncertainty as to the accuracy of these tests. And, I mean, they're still being developed. They're still being evaluated. If you were to go to, a drive-through clinic, which test are you actually getting? You probably don't know which test it is. What what procedural test, which manufacturer, which lab, what the turnaround time is, what the specificity is, what the accuracy is.
Right. And even as simple things as sample prep. So a lot of our listeners don't know or haven't worked in a biological laboratory or any chemical processing laboratory. But generally, if you have reagents or some sort of test that would, have a change based on, the antibodies being there, whether or not it'd be photoluminescence or whether or not it be some sort of change in color, or you can get it in like a PCR or looking at scatter or looking at absorption or whatever the test may be, the prep work is super important because these are going to be very fragile molecules. And if you don't do it correctly, then you have the chance of blowing the entire test. And when you're trying to go for speed, there's also the ability for you not to follow the process correctly. And then you end up again with then more testing bias because you're not following the known procedure because you're trying to go as fast as you can. So there's no validation. So you're only testing once. Which means that not only is the test not validated, but the testing procedure is now not validated, and then the person in the lab doing the test is not validated. And we call that sort of like a cascading or a stacking issue when we talk about uncertainties, and especially in uncertainty analysis. And the other thing that comes up with antibodies, and this is sort of our final little tidbit here, is we don't know whether or not antibodies are actually produced 100% of the time when you're sick with COVID-19. There's a body evidence or a body of research out there that's suggesting that if you have a short exposure or a short sickness and illness with COVID-19, your body may just use T cells to fight it off. And you may not actually get to the point in which you're making antibodies or the antigens needed for memory and continuation.
And I mean, yes, that entire concept is still being actively researched, so it may or may not be true, but it does kind of help to explain some of the asymptomatic cases as well, where people have tested positive for it without having shown any symptoms. And it could be that there's a couple different strains. There are different symptoms associated with each strain. It could be that the disease just randomly affects certain people differently. And I mean, part of that is also, encompassed by some of this testing uncertainty, where if you are asymptomatic and you test positive, what does that really mean? Does it mean that you had a full-blown case, or does it mean that, you ingested some mucus or something and it was in your nose, and then you did the test, and then you like kind of dry heaved, and then blew your nose and it all went out, and you never actually had it in terms of receiving symptoms?
Right. Yeah, and there's so much uncertainty here, especially if it's new. And so we have to really, really be careful with this reporting. And that leads us into now the politicizing of this, or the weaponizing of COVID-19 test numbers, because there's two competing scenarios here. One is that individuals should be safe, taken care of, and have what the worker needs, which is the, shelter, food, water, comfort from a family, right? No stress in their life, not to worry that they have to pay their bills, not to worry that they have to, go out and expose themselves to other people, not to be labeled some sort of a, essential worker because they are at a gas station but not given PPE. Right? There's that portion of it, right? Then competing with that is then the capital pull, which is the we need to have workers make money for the businesses I own. And we claim it's for the economy, but really it's not for the economy. It's for the individual landowners. It's for the business owners. And that's really the important context here because we always hear in the news that it's we need it for the economy. And yes, 70% of the economy is service worker, 9% is manufacturing, 20% is government. So we know those numbers, we break them down all the time. But the 70% that's service, right, that money just goes out of the hands of the worker into the service industry and into the pockets of the wealthy. And so that industry itself isn't necessarily needed in a time of pandemic. The workers need to be feeling safe. And so this is that gets into that political that feel.
So as numbers are reported, and there's been this gradual kind of decrease in the number of people that are dying each day in New York, which is objectively a good thing. Is that data sort of being presented through the lens of one of these political motivations, where, oh, the number of deaths is going down, so everything's fine. Everybody should return to work, and business owners should continue exploiting their workers and making money. Is that a propaganda usage of sort of these data skews that are occurring with various scientific reasons? So when you look at the data, there's an empirical scientific lens to look at, which is sort of what we just talked about, in that there are like actual valid reasons why the data may or may not be accurate. And then there's the presentation of the data to make it appear as though it, number one, is accurate, and number two, is going in a favorable direction to a certain political motivation.
Exactly right. And one of the examples is Georgia. So Georgia spent a lot of time trying to pump up positive news, saying things like, we're just like Sweden.
And you can go
At the same
there.
time, they reopened.
You
I'm
can
sorry,
go
go ahead.
bowling there.
Yeah, you go bowling there, right? And that's, I think that's the argument we used last time, which was bowling in Georgia makes no sense because who wants to go bowling right now in COVID-19? That the business owner wants you to because they have objectively a need to keep raising money in order to pay off all the debt that they've incurred in order to create the business and extract as much wealth from the business as possible. Sorry about that little bit of rant there. But in Georgia, they had an uptick in huge cases right after they opened up the state again. Right? But the news media is more like we're back to normal. And so it's this idea that we have positive news, even though we're having still an uptick in death rates. We still have Massachusetts, right? We still have Michigan, which is finally falling off. We're having Georgia with upticks. We're having Florida reopening beaches. We have a lot of places, California, that may be steady, but a steady number of sick is not tailing off. A steady number of sick means there's people still being infected, and it's at the cost of our most vulnerable workers, the ones who are exposed to people all the time. And so this is this sort of negative feedback loop that's going to happen in the media over the next few months, which is going to be numbers are going down, so we should reopen, and people go back out to their daily lives, and everybody gets sick, and then we reactionary shut everything down like we should, and then as it gets better, it's reactionary again about how good things are. And it's this idea, this feedback loop, that's going to actually do more harm than good because we keep looking for positive news. And so in the end, positive news is going to start killing our people and start killing the worker because we trust in the news to present to us an objective news sort of story, but it's not. It's geared towards sort of sensationalization of this entire COVID-19 pandemic.
The presentation of this data is creating a little bit of a warped perception of, as cases go down, and what does down mean? Generally, it's a kind of a naive interpretation of this number was smaller than the number yesterday, but people have a very difficult time understanding rates of change. So initially, when the pandemic sort of started happening in early March, maybe late February, you saw exponential growth, which was each day, something like 10% more people would become ill. And that growth rate of 10% each day has generally plateaued. And we're seeing something like, 3, 4, 5, 6%. Kind of nationally. And it's a small number relative to 10%, relative to what it was, but it still represents like over 30,000 additional cases. So it's not getting worse in terms of the rate of change, but it's not really getting better either. And over time, over the last month, people have sort of become desensitized to this. Well, it's not getting worse, therefore everything's better. And it's this strange human optimism concept that says, well, it's not affecting me. It's not affecting somebody I know. So I expect this to get better. So I don't need to social distance anymore. I don't need to follow these conventions. But it's very detrimental. And it leads to this feedback loop of everything's fine. I can resume my normal activities. That will cause cases to continue not only growing at the 3, 4, 5%, but to maybe have a day where you uptick to 6%. And as this moves along, and each day you get 2% growth and 2% growth and 2% growth, at day 30, when you have an uptick of 1%, it's thousands of people. But in the context of historical cases, it's just 1%. So, like, what does it really mean? And people have a very kind of non-intuitive interpretation of rates of change and sort of percentages in math over periods of time because of they become acclimated to what they want to happen. And we're being told that everything is fine and what we want to happen is happening.
Yeah, and it's driven by that fear number. And so I'll give you a little, I guess, a trick for doing exponential growth. So you take the rate of change, and so it was said that you had, let's just take inflation, which is supposed to be 3.5%. So you take the number 70 and divide it by the rate of change, so 3.5% per year. So 70 divided by 3.5 is 20. So that's the doubling time. So 70 divided by the percentage is doubling time. So if it's measured in percent per year, that's how many years it takes. And if it's in percents per day, that's how many days it takes. So back to the idea that we had a, let's say, 7% growth rate on COVID, that's if you take 70 divided by 7 a week, or 7%, sorry about that, it takes 10 days for the double. So that means doubling time of 1,000 to 2,000, 2,000 to 4,000, 4,000 to 8,000. You can see now how it's exponential growth, and in a matter of 40 days, you have yourselves from 1,000 to 2,000. 2,000, 4,000, find the 8,000 cases. And that's the whole rate of change idea. So again, if you just take the number 70 divided by the interest rate, that gives you doubling time. That could give you sort of a relative idea of how much it's going to take or how long it is. Hopefully what we see is it drop down to 1% or below 1%, in that we get sort of an interaction rate less than one. Once we get there, then it's more like a herd immunity where you can't catch it because there's not statistically a chance to get it. And we'll go over that potentially in another episode.
And just from a raw numbers perspective, we're not anywhere near herd immunity, but yeah, it is something on the horizon that we can, it's a light at the end of the tunnel where if enough people get sick and they develop immunity, there's the rate of transmission amongst those who are not sick basically falls to zero and the disease goes away because there's no future people to reinfect.
So the final point of this, as you wrap up this discussion, is that numbers are hard for people who don't do math all the time to truly understand, and we know that. So you have to be very careful when we ingest data that's piping out, because they don't tell you how they process the data. They don't tell you why averaging over 14 days was used instead of 7 days, or why they're saying 27 days here or not, or how why what. Is or the lag behind reported illnesses and number of deaths, or the difference in time between somebody who dies instantaneously from a stress from COVID versus somebody who dies whether intubated on a ventilator for 14 days, right? So all those numbers skew a ton of the growth rates. So we have to be very careful how we report that.
Yeah, so these artifacts all affect reporting, and we really can't know what the actual true numbers are, but we have to be cognizant that there is propaganda that is being perpetrated by corporations to perpetuate kind of their own self-interest. There might be some kind of governmental propaganda going on. You know, the election is coming up. There are many people in positions of government that have incentive to kind of juke the numbers. And we need to be aware that this could be happening, and we need to have some outlook on not necessarily being able to prevent it, but being able to call it out when we see it.
Yep, that's absolutely true. Because remember, capitalism, is going to do what it can to survive. And capitalism will do what it can to extract as much wealth from the workers as possible. And so these capitalistic motivations are inhibiting our ability to collect accurate scientific information. Because there's an incentive for us not to collect all the information. There's an incentive for the federal government to not collect data if their job is to create a better economy. Or if it's an election year, they don't want the numbers to look bad. Right, there's an incentive for New York to not count the number of dead bodies picked up that have no causation. Right, when the numbers are jumping that high, they don't do an autopsy. There's a reason why they're doing that. And so it's really important for us to remember that capitalism has motivations. It will cloud the judgment of policymakers, and it's going to expose workers to unnecessary health risks. And it's up to the workers. And I'm glad that we saw one the other day in Amazon strike. It's up to the workers to empower themselves and rely on each other for safety.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.